Hello and welcome to the Zero to Finals podcast. My name is Tom, and in this episode, I'm going to be talking to you about pulmonary embolism. If you want to follow along with written notes on this topic, you can follow along at zerotofinals.com/PE or in the respiratory section of the Zero to Finals medicine book. So let's get straight into it. Pulmonary embolism, which can be just shortened to PE, is a condition where there's a blood clot, which we call a thrombus, that forms in the pulmonary arteries. And this is usually the result of a deep vein thrombosis, or a DVT, that develops in the legs or in one of the other deep veins and travels, it becomes an embolism, through the venous system, then through the right side of the heart and into the pulmonary arteries, where it gets lodged in those arteries inside the lungs. Once the blood clot is lodged in the pulmonary arteries, it blocks the blood flow to the lung tissue, and it also creates a strain on the right side of the heart trying to pump blood past the clot. As you can imagine, this makes them quite dangerous. DVTs and PEs are collectively known as something called venous thromboembolism, or VTE. So what are the risk factors for developing venous thromboembolism, DVTs or PEs? Well, there's a number of risk factors. And in many of these situations, we actually give patients prophylactic treatment with injections of low molecular weight heparin to reduce their risk. And these are things like immobility, recent surgical procedures like replacement of a hip or replacement of a knee, long-haul flights, for example, from the UK to Australia. Pregnancy is a big risk factor for developing DVTs and PEs. Hormone therapy with estrogen, so these are things like the hormone contraceptive pill or hormone replacement therapy in postmenopausal women. Malignancy, so any cancer increases your risk. Polycythemia or high hemoglobin count makes your blood prone to clotting. Inflammatory conditions like systemic lupus erythematosus. And thrombophilia conditions such as antiphospholipid syndrome. A quick Tom tip, in your exams, when you're taking a history from a patient who's presenting with possible features of a DVT or a PE, ask them about risk factors such as periods of immobility, long-haul flights, recent surgery, possible cancers, and this will score you extra points from your examiners to show that you're thinking beyond just the problem that's right in front of you. We need to talk about VTE prophylaxis. Every patient who's admitted to hospital should be assessed for their risk of venous thromboembolism, or VTE. If they have an increased risk of VTE, they should receive prophylactic treatment, which is injections of low molecular weight heparin, such as enoxaparin, to prevent them from getting DVTs and PEs, unless these are contraindicated. And contraindications are things like active bleeding or existing anticoagulants like warfarin or NOAC. Antithrombolic compression stockings are also used unless they're contraindicated, and the main contraindication to compression stockings is peripheral arterial disease, and these compression stockings aim to increase the blood flow back out of the peripheries and prevent blood from pooling in the deep veins and DVTs from developing. How do patients with a pulmonary embolism present? Well, they can present with very subtle signs and symptoms. So in patients with potential features of PE, and risk factors for PE and no other explanation for their symptoms, you need to have a low threshold for suspecting, treating and investigating for a PE. Presenting features are things like shortness of breath, cough with or without blood, and a cough with blood is known as hemoptysis, pleuritic chest pain, and this is a sharp pain in the chest when breathing deeply, hypoxia, so they become low on oxygen. Tachycardia is a key feature, so think about PEs in patients with a high heart rate. Raised respiratory rate because they're hypoxic. They can get low-grade fevers. And in big PEs, they can become hemodynamically unstable, causing hypotension. So they can get cardiogenic shock because of the stress that this PE puts on the heart and the circulation. Patients presenting with features of PE may also have signs and symptoms of a deep vein thrombosis, such as unilateral leg swelling and tenderness. Let's talk about the Wells score. The Wells score is used to predict the risk of a patient presenting with symptoms of actually having a DVT or a PE. and it takes into account risk factors such as recent surgery, and it takes into account clinical findings like tachycardia and hemoptysis. And this gives you a score which tells you whether a PE is likely or unlikely based on the features. So how do you diagnose a patient with having a PE? Well, NICE recommend assessing for alternative causes because of the non-specific symptoms, and you use a history, examination and chest x-ray to look for things like pneumonia or pneumothorax or other conditions that can cause similar features. Then you would perform a Wells score, and you'd proceed based on the outcome of the Wells score. So if the Wells score says that a PE is likely, you go on to perform a CT pulmonary angiogram to establish a diagnosis. And if the Wells score says that a PE is unlikely, NICE recommend you first perform a D-dimer test. And if the D-dimer test is positive, then you perform a CTPA. So let's talk about the D-dimer test. D-dimer is a sensitive, and is about 95% sensitive, but not specific blood test for DVTs and PEs. So this makes it useful for excluding venous thromboembolism where there's a low suspicion, because we know it's almost always raised if there is a DVT or a PE. However, there's lots of other conditions that can cause a raised D-dimer. This is things like pneumonia, cancers, heart failure, recent surgery or pregnancy. So it's not a very useful test if there's an alternative diagnosis that's also likely to increase the D-dimer. Therefore, if we think there's a high risk of having a PE or a DVT, then there's no point doing a D-dimer because it's going to be raised and you're going to go on to do the further investigations anyway. It's also not a very useful test to just add on to blood tests, because often it comes back positive and then you end up in a dilemma where you're not sure whether to investigate or not for a possible DVT or a PE. Next, let's talk about the imaging. And there's two main options for establishing a definitive diagnosis of a PE. The options are a CT pulmonary angiogram or a CTPA, or a ventilation perfusion scan, which we call a VQ scan. CTPAs involve a chest CT scan using an intravenous contrast that highlights the pulmonary arteries. And by highlighting the outline of the pulmonary arteries, it demonstrates any areas of blood clot that don't become highlighted by the contrast. This is usually the first choice in investigating a pulmonary embolism, as it tends to be more readily available, it provides a more definitive assessment, and it gives information about alternative diagnoses like pneumonia or malignancy. A ventilation perfusion scan, or a VQ scan, involves using radioactive isotopes and a gamma camera to compare the ventilation of the lungs with the perfusion of the lungs. They're used in patients with renal impairment or contrast allergies, or who are at risk of radiation or have some other contraindication for a CTPA. So how do you do them? Well, first, the isotopes are inhaled to fill the lungs, and a picture is taken with the gamma camera to demonstrate the ventilation of the lungs, so the area that the isotopes enter in the lungs. Next, a contrast containing the isotopes is injected, and a picture is taken to demonstrate the perfusion of the lungs, and this is the area of the lungs that fill with blood. The two pictures, the ventilation picture and the perfusion picture, can then be compared, and with a pulmonary embolism there'll be a deficit in perfusion as the thrombus is blocking blood flow to the lung tissue in that area. So this area of lung tissue will be ventilated but not perfused. A quick Tom tip about ABGs in pulmonary embolisms. Patients with a PE often have a respiratory alkalosis when an ABG is performed. This is because they have a high respiratory rate that causes them to blow off extra CO2. So the low oxygen level, the hypoxia that they have, causes their respiratory rate to go up, which causes them to blow off CO2, and the low CO2 level in the blood causes the blood to become alkalotic. It's one of the few causes of a respiratory alkalosis. The other main cause is hyperventilation syndrome. And patients with a PE will have a low PO2, whereas in hyperventilation syndrome, they'll have a high PO2 because they're taking in more oxygen than they need. So if you see a patient who has respiratory alkalosis have a suspicion about whether this could be a PE. How do we manage a PE? Well, the first thing is these patients can be unwell, so they need supportive management with admission to hospital, oxygen as they require, analgesia if they're in a bit of pleuritic chest pain, and appropriate monitoring to check they don't deteriorate at all. The initial management is with the treatment dose of low molecular weight heparin. Examples are enoxaparin or dalteparin, and they have specific doses for people who have a PE. This should be started immediately before you confirm the diagnosis in patients where a DVT or PE is suspected and there's a delay in getting a diagnosis using a scan. Once they've started on treatment dose low molecular weight heparin, they're on the appropriate treatment, but they need a long-term plan, so you need to switch them to a long-term anticoagulant. And the options for long-term anticoagulation in DVTs or PEs are one of three things. They can have warfarin, they can have medications called NOACs, or they can have low molecular weight heparin. If they choose to go on warfarin, they need monitoring of their INR and titration of the dose, and the target INR for warfarin is between 2 and 3. When you switch from low molecular weight heparin to warfarin initially, you need to continue the low molecular weight heparin for 5 days, or until the INR is stable between 2 and 3 for 24 hours while they're on warfarin. NOACs, which are also called DOACs, are essentially oral anticoagulants that are not warfarin. They're an alternative option for anticoagulation, and they don't require monitoring and dose titration in the same way that warfarin does. Originally, they were called NOACs, meaning novel oral anticoagulants, but this has been changed to non-vitamin K oral anticoagulants because they're no longer novel. This is changing to DOACs, which stands for direct acting oral anticoagulants. And the main three options for NOACs or DOACs, whichever you prefer to call them, are apixaban, dabigatran, and rivaroxaban. Using injections of treatment dose low molecular weight heparin long-term is the first-line choice in pregnant patients or patients with cancer. And then you continue the anticoagulation for 3 months if there's an obvious reversible cause, and then you review to see whether you need to stop it. You continue it beyond 3 months if the cause is unclear, or if there's recurrent venous thromboembolism, or if there's an irreversible cause, such as an underlying thrombophilia, like antiphospholipid syndrome. Often if there's no clear cause, you'll continue for 6 months in reality. And then you continue for 6 months if they've got active cancer, and then you review. We need to talk about something called thrombolysis. Where there is a massive PE with hemodynamic compromise, there is a treatment option called thrombolysis. Thrombolysis involves injecting a fibrinolytic medication, and this means a medication that breaks down fibrin, and it rapidly dissolves the clot. There is a significant risk of bleeding with thrombolysis, which can make it dangerous. So it's only used in patients where there's a massive PE, where the benefits outweigh the risks. Some examples of thrombolytic agents are streptokinase, alteplase, and tenecteplase. And there's two ways that thrombolysis can be performed in a PE. You can give it intravenously through a peripheral cannula, and then it will travel up to the heart, up to the lungs, and dissolve the clot. Or you can give it directly into the pulmonary arteries using a central catheter. And this is called catheter-directed thrombolysis. And in catheter-directed thrombolysis, a catheter is inserted into the venous system and then guided through the right side of the heart and into the pulmonary arteries. And then the operator can administer a thrombolytic agent directly into the location of the thrombus. They can also use special equipment to physically break down the thrombus and aspirate it, take it out of the lungs. But when you do this, there is a risk of damaging the pulmonary arteries. So thanks for listening to this episode on pulmonary embolism. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it with your colleagues and help them with their revision too. And if you want to help me out, I'd be really grateful if you could leave me a rating or review on iTunes or whichever podcast app you use. And I hope you tune in for the next episode, which will be on pulmonary hypertension.